All right, everybody. Welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Phil, your administrator, and our next guest is Father Frank Morales. He's an Episcopal priest from New York City, and he's the head of the campaign to demilitarize the police. Welcome to the show, sir.
Nice to be with you.
It's very nice to have you on. Now, in searching your name on the Google, I found a letter that you wrote from Ground Zero, right? You were there on September 11th.
Yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, I was asked by the cathedral here to assist in the performance of Last Rites at Ground Zero. This was approximately 3 or 4 days after 9-1-1, so I was there early on, and I spent 2:11 p.m. to 7 a.m. shifts. Two successive nights, and I wrote that up. It was quite an, as you can imagine, overwhelming experience, and I wrote it up in a piece called Ground Zero, which is available on our website. And it was hard to really get that written, because it was a very difficult experience to comprehend up close that in that way. The main lesson, people can go look at the piece, but the main lesson that came out of that for me was that, because as I recount in the piece, at one point it was about 3:30 in the morning, and I'm sitting there, and mind you, as I was coming in to the actual site through various kind of concentric circles of security, and coming through Manhattan on the way downtown Manhattan, as you recall, the sentiment was, you know, there was a lot of fear and trauma. There was also a lot of anger, and, you know, let's go bomb somebody kind of a syndrome that was happening. And I'm not, you know, putting that down, because as what happened is that I was, you know, kind of not wanting to participate in that kind of a frenzy, because I felt that, you know, we really didn't know who did it, and it seemed a little bit premature to be targeting a certain group of people and so on and so forth. In any case, when I went down there at 3 in the morning, I found myself looking at this mass and blurting out, man, if I knew somebody in here, I'd really want to get those so-and-sos. Of course, I didn't use the term so-and-so at that time. And I really was just struck with my own anger. It just kind of welled up out of me, at which point one of the firemen who was standing with me at that time, who'd been there since the beginning, looking for his friends who were somewhere buried, he leaned over and said to me, you know, it's not about that. And he made the comment, and I swear, as I'm sitting here talking to you, he said to me, do you know that Bush and Bin Laden have the same banker? And I was, needless to say, stunned at that comment, coming from a, you know, a kind of a football player looking fireman guy, who then proceeded to, along with the other people there, manifest to me an attitude that had less to do with a revenge kind of an emotional setting, but who were really so immersed in the death and the destruction of it all, that it was really impossible for those people who were up close to it to want to inflict that on anyone else. It was kind of almost instinctual that when you were so literally, you know, there were people ground up in the earth we were standing in, it was impossible to summon that kind of energy, although, you know, some may say there's a time and place for that, but that's the point being, is that I was struck with the humanity of the people who were up close to the destruction, such that I found myself being kind of brought into, you know, I learned a lesson that day, you know, that it's a lot easier for people, all of us who are kind of armchair general, so to speak, or removed from the point of violence, to advocate one way or the other. Yeah, let's go bomb this one. Let's go do that. Let's go do this. But when you're really immersed in it, it's a whole different story. And I found the guys were saying we should have tour buses come through here so that people could see this, and maybe once and for all. Now I'm editorializing now, but maybe, you know, once and for all, we have to stop killing each other. I mean, it was such a basic kind of a lesson, but it was really brought home by those people who were unearthing the dead down there. So I tried to write that up, and I don't know how successful I was, but that piece is available on our website.
Well, and I think that's a very important point too, that, you know, the people across the river or you know, here in Texas were saying, yeah, let's go and get them. But the people
right.
at the scene were saying, you know, if this is what we've got to do to get back at whoever did this, let's
yeah.
call it off.
Yeah. Yeah, it was, it's beyond a certain kind of a logic and that kind of tit-for-tat logic. And it's not, again, it's not something that you consciously sit and just move to this position. But when you're immersed in that kind of scene, and again, it was nearly indescribable, you just mountains of twisted steel and soil and, you know, the stench of death. Literally, and it was kind of like being in Dante's Inferno, so that you were not functioning in a way in which you felt that let's go do this to someone else, because it was just instinctually not viable from a human point of view. To the extent that you were immersed in it, you were incapable of that, and that to me was a lesson that I think I feel blessed in a way to have had access to that moment, because it's not something that even in my telling it, it's you know, it may not ultimately make that much sense to people, for thank goodness we're not often situated within that kind of you know, deaths all around you kind of circumstance. But yeah, so it was quite an intense experience, and I've often thought about it.
Well, now, you were running this organization, the campaign to demilitarize the police, even before September 11th, right?
Yeah, well, we actually formed that as a group after that, but I've been involved in research around, for lack of a better term, a better way to put it, domestic operations of the Pentagon. Pentagon operations, which fall within their so-called operations other than war doctrine, which includes the what is referred to as civil disturbance suppression. So I was particularly interested in Pentagon plans around the suppression of dissent, which is codenamed, there's a contingency plan, which was originated in 1968 and is constantly updated, and quite literally, it's called Operation Garden Plot. Operation Garden Plot is quite literally a 200-page document. It's not some figment of some conspiracy theorist's imagination. It's a document that is a kind of a how-to deal with civil disturbance, so-called civil disturbance, dissent, civil disobedience, et cetera, from you know, the legal parameters involving the military in this kind of quote-unquote law enforcement exercise, and so forth and so on. So I was researching Pentagon operations domestically, particularly around dissent, and came upon some documents that refer to Homeland Defense. Now, this was in 1997. So obviously, by 2001, September, and then shortly thereafter, the phrase Homeland Defense began to become more public. I had written an article on Homeland Defense in 1999 for Covert Action Quarterly magazine. So as a result, I, needless to say, got a lot of attention, because people had never heard of that phrase. But in fact, those can be traced back in Pentagon circles back to the mid-90s. And quite honestly, the focus was less on, you know, there was a kind of anti-terrorism you know, component to it, but was specifically geared towards civil disturbance suppression, was geared towards a kind of homeland security apparatus that was targeting domestic dissent.
Which brings up the question of whether the new Department of Homeland Security is created for that same purpose.
Yeah, it's becoming more and more clear as, you know, we see the machinations, if you will, of the police apparatus on the street, so to speak, because that's where we really see, you know, what's going on, kind of where the tire hits the road. The FBI has formed a number of joint terrorist task forces around the country, which are the nexus of local, state, and federal law enforcement. They're kind of a meeting point, these JTTFs, and there are close to 70 of them around the country now. And these are places where the FBI is basically coordinating what they refer to as preventive law enforcement. It's not the old notion of someone commits a crime and then law enforcement, you know, picks it up at that point. This is a whole other notion of enforcement involving the FBI, which has to do with preventative action. And we're seeing in the case in recently in Iowa at Drake University, where there was instrumental in getting a bunch of subpoenas issued to students and so forth for nothing other than being involved in an anti-war rally. We're seeing more and more the use of Joint Terrorist Task Force and anti-terrorist police work focusing on protest. So it's becoming obvious that to a large extent the Department of Homeland Defense, Homeland Security, the consolidation of local, federal, state, and federal law enforcement appears to have, at least as one of its agenda aspects, a kind of counterinsurgency. Because, you know, that's the term that is used internationally by such organizations as the CIA, who mount preventive, preemptive kind of actions under the heading of what they refer to as counterinsurgency. It's countering insurgencies that are within society, vis-a-vis a government, policies of a particular government, and so forth and so on.
So they're making it clear that really what they're worried about is dissent against their operations, as opposed to Al-Qaeda terrorist cells hiding.
Yeah, I mean, that's just, if you just look at it objectively, it's more and more obvious that there's more about dissent that concerns these people than actually does terrorism. Look at the funding. You hear municipalities across the country, here in New York, people don't have the resources to do the kinds of security that they think is necessary. There doesn't seem to be that much as much zeal going into it. When Mueller from the FBI, Director Mueller, make statements like, and I'm pretty much quoting, that there's a continuum between dissent and terrorist activity. They're pretty much opening up the door to a kind of COINTELPRO, a new style COINTELPRO counterintelligence program, which was operative in the 60s and 70s against protests, illegally sanctioned protests, spying and disinformation and in some cases actual some, according to some reports, physical assaults. It's only this time it's above ground, it's legal. The most recent case of this kind of federalization of local law enforcement and a kind of a politicized federalization of local law enforcement is the case that we're focusing on here, which is our own congressional representative Carolyn Maloney. This past November, put forth a bill in the House which would legally amend the 1949 CIA Act and allow for the stationing of CIA agents within local police departments.
And that's this new bill, H.R. 3439?
H.R. 3439. The long and the short of it is that our campaign here, which is primarily focused on demilitarizing, de-escalating in terms of violent capabilities, police response to protests, particularly gearing up for the RNC in the August and so forth. But even beyond that, we need to break the increasing limit, the increasing consolidation of police as an entity and military as an entity, and maintain a bright separation, a sharp separation between those two functions. Someone
might argue that putting CIA and local police, everybody knows CIA is all for foreign operations, so if they were putting CIA and local police, that probably wouldn't be to mess with you and I, right? Isn't that for protecting us from Al-Qaeda?
That's what's being argued. But that's what the Church Committee reports in the mid-70s uncovered. While they were exposing, and this is public information, people can go find this out. The Church Committee, this is named after Frank Church, in 1976 issued a series of final reports from their intelligence committee, a series of hearings, and they uncovered massive surveillance spying on the part of the CIA domestically against anti-war groups and women's and black and Latino organizations and so forth and so on, environmental groups, under the codename Operation Chaos. They have a whole expose of Operation Chaos within these congressional documents, and they're available to you. And if you look at that, the rationale that was used to spy on peace groups and so forth was the same as we're seeing today, looking for the foreign contact. In this period, in the 60s and 70s, it was to try to, delineate foreign support, particularly Cuban or Soviet in those days, support for the peace movements and the women's movements and so forth. And again, to make a long story short, but this is available for people to read themselves, they were not able to find these foreign connections, and they had to admit that these were pretty much indigenous responses to government policies and so forth and so on. It didn't stop them from carrying out their spying, though. At the height of it, 300,000 U.S. citizens were part of a database, and they were kept track of, for having committed no crimes other than, a redefined crime of subversion or something, which is, begins to move towards the overt repeal of our First Amendment rights and so forth. So what we're seeing today is, in a very similar way, mind you, we have 911 now to keep that kind of argument alive, that there are foreign terrorists who are threatening us in these various ways. But nonetheless, we've yet to see anyone seriously indicted or charged even in the 911 case itself, let alone other, potential terrorists and so forth. But, when you define terrorism as the Patriot and the various other legislative edicts that have come out, particularly since 911, the definition of terrorism is always allows for it to be utilized against protests. The definitions move towards the kind of statements that go, for example, like, any attempt to coerce or intimidate a government through, pressure, and it's those kinds of words. When we're talking about civil disobedience, we're literally talking about a kind of moral force that's being applied to a government in order to affect and policy. And yes, it could be argued that that's coercive.
As Bob Barr just pointed out when I interviewed him right before you, that they get to define it all, and they get to
exactly
redefine it and redefine it as much as they want.
Exactly,
just like George Orwell.
Yeah, so I mean, I think when we're looking at a president and an administration who, in front of the whole world, acted unilaterally, although we'd want to say that we had UN cover for this and our allies and so forth, but pretty much you know, the Bush administration feels that it really doesn't need to function within the parameters of international law or domestic law. So,
well,
you know,
I happen to agree with them that they don't need to go to the UN. I mean, I disagree with all the wars that they've had.
No, I'm not even saying that they should go to the UN, but they'll utilize that kind of language in order to cover their tracks. Who knows what's going on behind the scenes?
Sure.
But my point being is that they're not, you know, amenable to having any kind of controls. And when you think in terms of an agency like the CIA, that is by definition, you know, covert and functions covertly, operating within local law enforcement, it's a very dangerous situation. I mean, the institutionalization of the Northern Command, which is a domestic military command, which was set up, oh, it's going on 2 years now, based in Colorado Springs, Colorado. They are a domestic military command. It's unprecedented, whose primary focus of attention is the U.S. itself, and who are set up to, quote-unquote, assist law enforcement. These kinds of developments move us towards, for lack of a better way to express it, a totalitarian police state kind of arrangement, given, if we look at nothing else other than history, a telltale sign of these totalitarian kind of police state societies is just that, it's a consolidation between the military and the police function. Police are you know, set up and organized to enforce the laws and to deal with criminal activity and at the same time to uphold a person's civil rights and civil liberties within a civilized society. The military is not set up to deal with the niceties of civil liberties. They're there to neutralize an enemy. It's a totally different function. And since we've seen technology transfers from military to the Pentagon, going way back now, and military involvement in such, you know, catastrophes as Waco and other kinds of militarized police response, whether it's in Miami during the FTAA protests and so forth, we are in a situation now where it's very critical, and one of the things that our campaign is pushing for is to recodify and reaffirm the Posse Comitatus Act. The Posse Comitatus Act is an 1878 statute, which is a very short criminal statute, but it is the bulwark, the foundation of the military, the police-military separation. And it states that the military shall not enforce laws domestically at the point of jail. And this is an act which allows for the maintenance of this separation, this critical separation, upon which, one might say our democracy, our constitutional form of government is based. It's essential.
I'm sorry to cut you off, Father Morales, but we're almost out of time here.
Mm-hmm.
I'd just like to ask you real quick. I put this question to Bob Barr a second ago.
Yeah.
He's been working with the ACLU and all kinds of things like that. And so I want to pitch to you my idea of a real realignment here, where instead of fighting between the left and the right, that the whole thing comes around to a fight between the statists and the people who want to be free. And that maybe the people on the left, like yourself, and the people on the right, like Bob Barr, and the libertarians, like myself, that we can all get together here and, effectively, not just try, but actually win at preserving liberty.
Yeah, well, I'm in total agreement. My philosophy has always been that we shouldn't get lost within the abstract realms of ideology. And when I say abstract, I understand that people have, we all do, we have a kind of a theoretical and a series of ideas that we keep in our head, and it helps us to rationalize and to understand our reality and how we put it together, and in some cases how we take a stand on a particular position. But I think what we're moving towards now is that we need, as a community of people who want to maintain our freedoms, to focus in on concrete, practical campaigns where we can work together and work together and begin to come together, and don't let abstractions separate us. We're never going to solve, you can't resolve a contradiction in the abstract. We can sit and discuss this and discuss that from in the abstract, but we're looking together at HR 3439 or the fighting to reaffirm posse comitatus and make sure that, you know, we don't turn our police into an occupation army in our own communities. We should do that, and we should move towards that. I'll give one example very briefly, which is in the 70s, there were a whole lot of so-called, and you know, I'm not putting them down. They may have thought of themselves this way, but there were people who considered themselves Marxists who were, you know, there were guerrillas throughout Latin America. There were also Christians who were feeding poor people and attempting to, you know, walk in Jesus' footsteps in terms of his solidarity with poor people and so on. So they were doing their thing. The Marxists were doing their thing. When they found themselves both in the gun barrel of death squad activity and so forth, unfortunately very often promoted by our own government, they found themselves in the same foxhole together. So there were discussions and books and things that were written which, you know, tried to deal with these in an abstract way. But the point they were making was that people moved from a Christian Marxist dialogue to Christian Marxist alliances and all kinds of things like that. The ideologies were never merged. You can't make something into what it's not. And this is what I mean.
But
practically speaking, exactly, and that's what makes all the difference in the world. We get over our hang-ups, and we begin to work together on concrete programs together where we can make real change.
Great. I'm sorry, we're just really short on time here. I've got a.
That's quite all right. I enjoy talking with you.
What's your website?
You can reach us at demilitarize.http/ because it's a temporary website. It's demilitarize the police, one long phrase, demilitarize the police, .netfirms, NETFIRMS,
cool.
Netfirms.com. Demilitarize the police, .netfirms.com.
And if anybody has trouble finding that, if you go to the antiwar.com blog, they have a link.
Yeah, or if you just search demilitarize the police, you'll probably get it as well.
Great. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Well, thank you.
Have a good one.
You take care.